All right. I'm going to tell you about a particular data set I've been working on in the last few years. And it's centered on this particular cluster on 47 Tuck. I'll briefly touch upon a couple of topics that have to do with star clusters as dense laboratories. The three topics I want to touch upon are extreme mass segregation in the core of 47 Tuck, a binary main sequence, so a population of stars above the main sequence that could be due to binaries, and finally I'll talk about blue stragglers in the core of 47 Tuck. Blue stragglers have been studied for a while, and it's an ideal place to study them because it's a very dense cluster. Now, I wouldn't be standing up here today if it weren't for the work of James Clem, who's a graduate student at the University of Victoria. He's doing a PhD with Don Vandenberg, but he's, as a side project, he's working on this data set with Peter Stetson and myself. And of course, Ron Gilliland was the PI of the project that led to the data set I'm going to be talking about. Ron put together the wonderful image that set of images that I've been playing with. Okay, a little bit more about Ron's work in just a moment. Let me start by telling you a little bit about 47 Tuck. You've heard a great deal about it earlier in this conference. There's been some debate about whether it's pre-core collapse or post-core collapse. At any rate, it has a well-defined core radius that's something like 12% of the half-mass radius, something like a 20 to 25 arcsecond core radius. It has a very high stellar density, arguably the highest central density of non-post-core collapse clusters. That's quite a mouthful. And it has a high degree of concentration. The particular image or set of images I'll be talking about were actually obtained for a project that has little to do with stellar populations in globular clusters. This was a search for planetary transits for hot Jupiters that happened to cross in front of a main sequence star in 47 Tuck. And if that would happen, you would see an eclipse. In fact, you'd see periodic eclipses that would be at a level of a percent or so. 1% of the light of the star would be blocked by this Jupiter. And so there was about an 8-day period, a 120 orbit program, where the Whitefield Planetary Camera and HST took repeated snapshots. And we're looking for repeated blinks from stars. We looked at something like 40,000 stars. We expected to see 20 planetary transits if you scale from what's known from radial velocity searches on solar type stars. We expected to see 17 to 20 transits, and we saw none. And so that says something about the population of planets in 47 Tuck, either due to dynamics or low metallicity. 47 Tuck stars are less abundant in planets than solar type stars. But that's a subject for a whole other talk. What I'm going to focus on are a set of V and I band images that were that go very deep, and a more limited set of U band images. These are really F555W, F814W, and F336W in the case of the U band. What we did was a very careful dither pattern. So we stepped the telescope pointing between exposures in a 10 by 10 grid of pointings. And roughly speaking, these 10 by 10 grids are stepped by about a tenth of a pixel in X and Y. So you can imagine it's a very well sampled, you can create a very well sampled image from this data set, and Ron Gilliland did just that. So we have images in VI and U that have four times finer pixel scale than a standard or a normal HST image, and that's really going to be the basis of what I'll talk about today. The co-added images are very deep, they're high resolution, they're super sampled by a factor of 4x4. So they're special, even relative to this whole concept that there can be a normal HST image versus an abnormal or supernormal HST image is sort of new to me. So what I want to emphasize is 47 Tuck is very crowded, and you need this resolution. So even at HST resolution, doing careful identification of stars sorting out blends, photometry of stars, is a challenge even at HST resolution. And a case in point is there was a controversy over the core radius of 47 Tuck, and just to give you a brief history of this, the ground-based studies suggested that the core radius of 47 Tuck was about half an arc minute. We did a paper in 1992 using early images from the Hubble Space Telescope, which had the aberrated point spread function. We got a value that was consistent with that, but in a couple of papers, one led by Daniela Calzetti and one led by Guido Di Marchi, they suggested that the ground-based studies had misidentified the center of the cluster, and so of course if you did that you would get an artificially large core. There was some excitement that the core of 47 Tuck may be very small and may in fact be a post-core collapse cluster and may have an unusual shape. In a later study, we looked more carefully at some of the same data sets that had been used to make the claim of a very small core radius. And we found that, in fact, we can explain the discrepancy in terms of increasing photometric error as you approach the crowded cluster center. And in fact, we found a core radius that was back to a little over 20 arc seconds. And there's a plausible set of reasons why there were these discrepant measurements. I won't go into that today. Bottom line is HST resolution is critical for a cluster as dense as 47 Tuck. I just thought I'd spend a couple of minutes giving you a visual display of what these images look like. This is a tiny section of 47 Tuck. This is, let me see if I can calculate this right. This is about an arc second by 2 arc seconds in size. This is a tiny section of the core of 47 Tuck in 3 filters, in the U, V, and I from left to right. And this is a relatively low contrast rendition of this section of the cluster. I say relatively low contrast, but even at this contrast, you can see that this star is sort of burnt out and you can't really see its separation from its neighbor. So you can go to lower contrast. I'm obviously not going to show you a whole movie of the possible contrast level, but this is a relatively low contrast image. If you go to slightly higher contrast, you can't even tell that there are two stars there. But you can start picking up fainter things that you couldn't see before. I'm just going to toggle back and forth a little bit. You can pick up faint stars like, say, that one that you couldn't see before. And the next panel, what I'm going to show you, is an attempt to remove 4 of the brightest stars in this section. And we've done this just in the V and I. And we have this for you. In fact, we have versions with every possible star that we've been able to detect removed. So of course, this is a step-by-step process, and I'm only showing you a few steps in this. Again, let me just toggle back and forth, and you can see that even these very bright, badly saturated stars, we have some information about how bright they are and what their positions are from shorter images in which these stars were not saturated. And we have to model the point spread function quite far away from the star up to large radii, and we can pick out faint stars in the wings of bright stars. The photometry isn't great for these stars, but for certain purposes, it's very useful to be able to get a complete star list in the core. Now, we're only complete down to some limiting magnitude, of course. So this is just to give you a flavor. Let me just run through this one more time. Low contrast, higher contrast in UV and I, and then the 4 stars. There's 1, 2, 3, 4 stars subtracted off in V and I. Okay. I want to emphasize that this is really, in terms of depth, angular resolution, and dynamic range, this is a pretty exceptional data set. One of the things we've used this data set for is to measure the luminosity function, stellar luminosity function, in the core of 47 Tuck, and then a few core radii outside the core of 47 Tuck. So this is the inner sample here. You can see the range of radii represented there. Just to remind you, the core of 47 Tuck is 20-some arc seconds. So this is all within the core. This is what we had from our... This is the stars getting fainted towards the right here. This is the main sequence turnoff. There's a very sharp rise of the main sequence turnoff. So the giant branch, roughly power law along the giant branch, subgiant branch, main sequence turnoff. These are main sequence stars. And we noticed even in sort of the the archival WIFP2 data, which is the quote-unquote normal HST data, we noticed that the data tracked sort of theoretical model luminosity functions based on power law mass functions out to some magnitude, and then it sort of peeled down, presumably because of incompleteness. Now, when you go to this much deeper data set, we track the same power law out to fainter magnitudes, but again, at the very faint end, it starts peeling down. It's sort of reassuring that where the old data set started peeling away from the model luminosity function is also the divergence point between between the new and old data sets. So we think in the core, the mass function is very top heavy. If you look at these x values here, these x values are in units where the saltpeter value is plus 1.35. We're getting values of negative 4, and even more negative if you restrict it to just the central, say, 15, 20 arc seconds. I won't have time to show that here, but if you go somewhat further out in the cluster, this is now a few core radii out. Again, the old data set looked like it was very close to a power law, out to some limiting magnitude, and then it sort of broke away because of incompleteness. And right at that point, the new data set just sort of keep going along that same, with that same power law. So over about a factor of 2 in stellar mass, going from something like 0.9 solar masses at the turnoff to about half a solar mass at the faint end, things look like they're well approximated by a power law. We played a few games with these data sets. I just want to emphasize that the slope is very negative in the inner part, not quite as negative as you go a little further out. Played a few games with this. This is a very top-heavy mass function. This is now the mass function slope x as a function of radius, and just pay attention to the solid symbols there. That's sort of the trend we're seeing in, due to mass aggregation, presumably, of the mass function getting progressively top-heavy as you approach the cluster center. Now, we've played a whole bunch of games with whether some of this could be due to incompleteness, because, you worry about, remember, as you approach the cluster center, crowding gets worse. And so, of course, faint-end incompleteness is going to mimic the same mass aggregation effects. Now, this is where HST was built very cleverly. It has a planetary camera chip that has high resolution, and it has a wide-field camera chip that has lower resolution. So at the same radial distance from the cluster center, you can get very different crowding effects depending on which chip you're on. So we've tried to exploit that fact and compared mass functions in at same radial distances from the cluster center but on different chips. And in fact, we see no if you restrict yourself to the magnitude range where we think we're complete, we see no difference in the derived mass function slope. Another way of putting this is if you can calculate something like a stellar crowding factor, which is not the number of stars per unit area in terms of arc seconds, but number of stars per unit number of area in pixels. So that's a measure of how crowded the image is. And if you do that, there isn't a clear trend in that. At very different crowding levels, as quantified by this parameter, we measure the same mass function slope. Okay? So these are, I can go into much more detail about these tests if anyone's interested. The bottom line is, we think the measured slope is robust, and it's not affected by faint-end incompleteness. Over here, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes, but these are two separate chips. So the trend you see for a particular symbol is the radial trend within a given chip. But the point is, the two chips don't lie on top of each other. That's exact. I didn't go into the details of this, but I can. Those are the kinds of tests we've been carrying out. Let me say a little bit about the main sequence of 47 Tuck. This is now the core of 47 Tuck, but restricted to stars for which there was a clean subtraction of the point spread function. So this is not every star in the core, but stars that are relatively isolated, stars that happen to be well separated from bright neighbors. And I've used a relatively unusual combination of colors and magnitudes. I'm plotting the I magnitude here and a U minus I color. And what I'm trying to do is make the main sequence as horizontal as possible. Because I want to stretch out, I want to use a long color baseline to stretch this out as much as possible. And also using the I magnitude helps there to make the main sequence as horizontal as possible. The reason for that is if you do that, then the binary main sequence stands well apart from the primary main sequence. And I probably doesn't take much imagination to see that there is sort of a scatter of points above the main sequence. If you take vertical cuts across the main sequence, the distribution of stars is not perfectly symmetric. There's a tendency for stars to be preferentially above the main sequence. Let me try to guide your eye. So this is if you think of this as the ridge line, this would be 0.75 magnitudes up, and that region is populated by stars. Now, this is right in the core of 47 Tuck, r less than 30 arc seconds. We've played a similar game slightly further out. It's a few core radii out. And again, you see the main sequence ridge line, and you see a few stars above the main sequence turn off. So I'm going to try and quantify this next. What I've done for, let's take this one as an example, is you can take, let's exclude this the upper part of the main sequence and the turnoff. Let's take color cuts that go from there to there, and let's collapse this distribution along the main sequence ridge line. This is like asking what is the vertical distance of each star from that yellow line. Okay, so and I can plot up a histogram of these offsets. That's what I'm about to show you. So this is a histogram now of these offsets. So you can see that it's not perfectly symmetric, but the departure from symmetry is very subtle. It's not very obvious in this diagram. What I've done is I've taken the left side of this histogram and folded it around to the right side, and that's what the dashed histogram is. You can see that there is a slight tendency for there to be an excess, and if you calculate the fraction of stars in that excess, it's about 10%. Now, if you do this was there a question?
Sorry, just a question. Did you check for possible blank?
I'll talk about that in just a minute. One way to do that is to go to the wide field camera chip, which is further out, but the point spread function is coarser, and the crowding effect is roughly the same. So that's one way. That's an empirical way to look at it. Of course, sort of the best way to do this is through artificial star experiments, which we're in the process of doing. But if you do this for the wide field camera chip, there isn't as much of an excess. It's a few percent, and that's about our measurement error for one thing, because you can see the histogram is not perfectly symmetric. Also, you can do a very simple back of the envelope calculation. There are something like 10 million pixels on our planetary camera chip. Instead of being a normal 800 by 800 image, it's four times oversampled, so it's a 3,000 by 3,000 pixel image, so there are about 10 million pixels. There are something like, ballpark, 10,000 main sequence stars in that same chip that we detect. Okay, so 10,000 stars, 10 to the 4 stars, if I can write over here, 10 to the 4 stars, but 10 to the 7 pixels. Now, you might imagine that if a second star were to land on the pixel that the first star is on, you wouldn't detect it. You'd call that a blend. But it wouldn't have to land exactly on. You can imagine there might be a few pixel by few pixel area around each star. That's sort of its blending zone, if another star landed within it. So if you said that there's 10 pixels associated with every star, say a 3x3 box around each star, where another star landing there wouldn't be resolved, then we're still talking about 1% of these stars should be blends, roughly 1%, maybe 2, depending on exactly how you how you draw that box around the star. Remember, these histograms are based on color magnitude diagrams that are based on clean stars that have very nice PSF subtraction. So you couldn't have, If there were a blend of stars that were separated by a few pixels, you would see that, and you would throw that out of the sample anyway. Okay. So we think the contamination just from chance superposition is something like somewhere between 1% and 2%. And that's consistent with what we see out in this. So it's consistent with the picture that these are all chance superposition, and there's about 10% real binaries in the core of 47 tab. Let me spend a few minutes talking about blue stragglers next. This is actually a CMD that Mike Rich showed yesterday. It's part of his last montage of color magnitude diagrams. I think this is part of your 74, Mike, if I'm not mistaken. Part of the 74. So this is the very same data set that we've analyzed. This is B minus V color. It's a function of V magnitude. And you can sort of see the red clump. You can see the base of the giant branch. There's a turnoff here. There's so many points here that you can't really see the details here. But there's some extension above the main sequence turnoff there that looks suspicious. And we tried to divide stars in this region, this sort of blue straggler region, into the bright blue stragglers, things that are more than things that are well removed from the main sequence turnoff, these things here, faint blue stragglers that are closer down, and then finally this set of points that are suspiciously above the main sequence turnoff, and we sort of, I said, blends question mark. There are about 200 stars over there. So depending on whether you call those blue stragglers or not, you can greatly affect your blue straggler statistics. Now, we noticed that many of these stars line up on the inner edge of the Whitefield camera chips. So there's no reason why the cluster should know about the Whitefield planetary camera. So we think those stars are mostly blends. And let me try to, this didn't come out very nicely in the translation to PowerPoint, but here are sort of all the stars that we could detect in the cluster, and the cluster core is completely burnt out right in the on the PC chip. Now remember, these are sort of normal HSD images. These are our bright blue stragglers, and indeed they're very strongly concentrated towards the cluster center, even more strongly concentrated than normal cluster stars. Then you know the fraction of bright blue stragglers increases as you approach the cluster center. And this is this magic circle that Fred Rossio gave me. This is, I guess, the millisecond pulsars and 47 tuck are all within that radius. And most of the bright blue stragglers are within that radius, not all of them, though. The faint blue stragglers, by contrast, have a somewhat more extended distribution. Their radial distribution is actually consistent with that of the giants, and you can't see that obviously in this rendition. But I want to draw your attention to the stars that are possible blends. These are the stars above the main sequence turnoff, and this is what I mean. You know, yes, their number increases as you approach the cluster center, and falls off as you march away from the cluster till you hit the chip boundary, and their number goes up again. The surface density goes up again. So we tried to use this to we tried to exploit this difference in resolution between PC and Whitefield camera to tell what fraction of these stars are blends and what fraction are real blue stragglers, because there could be real blue stragglers hiding in that part of the color magnitude diagram. So the trick we were using is, you know, the factor by which your blending probability increases as you cross the chip boundary, because the density of the cluster hasn't changed, but your pixel size and PSF have grown by a factor that you can quantify. And that factor is roughly a factor of 5. So you expect a factor of 5 increase in the surface density of blends as you cross the chip boundary. Now suppose you were to see if you look at the actual distribution, suppose you were to see a factor of 3 increase instead of a factor of 5 increase, that says that there are real blue stragglers that are diluting this step. So you can use this to quantify what fraction of these 185 blends are real blue stragglers. And the number we came up with is something like 15% of those are probably real, but 80% of them are likely to be blends. So at least statistically, you can say how many blue stragglers are hiding in that part of the color magnitude diagram. Now,
are you saying that it's due to the edge of the chip, or that it's just due to going into a region of higher crowding?
It is a matter of going into a region of higher crowding, but there's a it depends both on the crowding and on the PSF and pixel scale, of course. And the latter, the PSF and pixel scale, have a big jump across the chip boundary. So we can exploit that. Because you, if they were all blends, then you expect the surface density to go up purely by a factor of 5, which is roughly the ratio of pixel areas between WFPIC and PC. But what we observe is an increase in surface density, but not quite by a factor of 5. And you can try to pull out what the you know, what the fraction of real blue stragglers are that are hidden in there, and came up with a number. So we said about 25 of the 185 are real blue stragglers. That was our estimate. Now you can do much better with this new high resolution image, because you can look at individual stars that were classified as blue stragglers or blends before, and look at them on this super duper image. So this is on each of these things. On the left panel shows you this deep super sampled HST image, the new image, and on the right is the normal HST image. Now sometimes it's a really unfair comparison, because the blue straggler was on the wide field camera of the old data set, and it's on the PC camera of the new data set. So there's, you know, no competition. You know, it's very difficult to say what's going on there, but you can clearly see that, you know, there are multiple stars over there. You know, this is the wide field camera on the old data set and the wide field camera on the new data set. This is where the super resolution game helps you a great deal. You can really see that, you know, there are three stars over there very clearly, whereas you couldn't tell that easily before. So all of these, you know, all six stars over here are examples of what we think are blends, because, you know, here's a star that was, you know, clearly two separate stars. Here's another one that's not so clear, but again, and if you do a PSF subtraction, it's very clear that these are two stars. Here are two stars again. Here again is a multiple. That and that were not resolved before. You know, this star was seen as a separate star. You can see. Whereas on the right-hand side are examples of stars that we don't think are blends. Okay, and you know, this the possible exception of this guy over here. And you can see the subtracted image looks a little funny over there. So on a star-by-star basis, you can learn a great deal by going to this super sampled image and comparing it to sort of the normal HST image. It really makes normal HST images look bad in this comparison. Okay, so let me now show you the color magnitude diagram around the blue straggler region based on this new data set, and this is what's up right now. And you can see that this plume of stuff right above the main sequence turnoff has gone away in this new color magnitude diagram. And in fact, the blue straggler sequence looks, you know, sort of roughly like a continuation of the main sequence there. Those are those stars. And if I can contrast that, that first CMD was right in the core. This is a few core radii out. And you notice, again, there are still blue stragglers here, but they're fraction, if you quantify the number of blue stragglers divided, say, by the number of giants of the same brightness, the fraction of blue stragglers is lower out here than it is in the core. And again, we think this is because of mass aggregation, presumably. I'm exactly about to, thanks. It's like I planted Harvey over there. This is exactly what I was about to do. So that rectangle there is a rough representation of the blue stragglers in the core. But if you were to take that same rectangle and draw it on the other diagram, you'll notice two things. The blue stragglers further out are somewhat redder, and they don't go out to as high luminosities. Okay, so the two distinct differences between the blue straggler population in the inner part and the outer part. Now, these are now the luminosity function of these blue stragglers. So this is the number of blue stragglers as a function of their absolute magnitude. Again, in the core, outside the core, the data are these histograms here. And I've overplotted one of Allison Sill's blue straggler models. So this is based on correct me if I'm wrong, Allison, but this is based on a collisional model with a mass function slope of -5, which is comparable to what's actually measured in the core of 47 Tuck, and it's a reasonable fit to the data. If you go to the outer parts, it's very difficult to match this blue straggler, the observed blue straggler luminosity function. The lack of luminous blue stragglers is difficult to understand in the outer parts of the cluster. And one way to explain that, courtesy Allison, is if you were to for some reason, if you were to say the Blue Straggler formation stopped a few gigayears ago, if you truncate it, then you could get stars, you introduce a time delay, so of course the luminous Blue Stragglers have evolved off the Blue Straggler sequence by now. I have no explanation for why there should be a truncation. If anyone does, please let me know. I'm just going to show you a version of this with the new data set. This luminosity function is in the core of 47 Tuck. It's weighted towards, it's rich in luminous Blue Stragglers. The luminous Blue Stragglers are to the left of this diagram, whereas the cumulative distribution in the somewhat further out lacks those same luminous Blue Stragglers. All right. The final thing I want to mention, just going to show you this plot, I'm not going to say very much about it. There's this intriguing class of red stragglers that people have been talking about. Josh Grindley was telling me about, one's an M67 and NGC6397 is the other one. There's something like half a dozen to a dozen of these stars in 47 Tuck. They are to the red of the subgiant branch. It wouldn't be surprising just to see stars out there. There's a huge scatter in our color magnitude diagram. But what's intriguing is all of these stars are variable. They're sinusoidal variables with something like up from half day to one day periods. They were found in our planet search. During our planet search, we were looking for variability. Of course, we found all the variable stars. But this particular class that's to the red of the main sequence and turnoff. Was dubbed, these stars were dubbed red stragglers. They have X-ray counterparts. The X-rays are variable, I'm told, and so they could well be contact binaries. Now, exactly why they're in this part of the color magnitude diagram remains a bit of a mystery to me.
How did you decide which dots to paint red?
They're variable. All of these stars are variable.
Only those few are variable.
Exactly. There are other variables that are eclipsing binaries and stuff on the main cluster sequences. Those are not shown here. But this particular class of variables, these sinusoidal variables, all of these happen to be variable. And they're also coincident with X-rays and variable X-rays.
Is this the sinusoidal variability?
I suppose, yeah. I mean, they would have to be what you were saying, yeah. But it's off the order of a day, half a day to a day. Let me quickly summarize the main things I've talked about. So I'd like to emphasize that there'll be quite a few interesting things coming out of this very deep high resolution, four times oversampled HST WFPIC2 image. It's difficult to beat this image even with ACS data. We've got some ACS data in the core of 47 Tuck. They have slightly higher resolution with ACS, but obviously nowhere near this depth yet. The full width half maximum of the point spread function for those who've been playing with HST images is something like 70 milliarcseconds on the PC chip and a little over 100 milliarcseconds on wide field camera. And unless you have very well dithered images, you never achieve this point spread function. There's a substantial improvement in photometric accuracy, completeness, and sort of contamination, things like blends contaminating a sample over normal HST images. We see pronounced mass segregation, well approximated by a power law over about a factor of 2 in stellar mass, from turn-off mass to half that. The index that varies from about -1 in the outer parts to something like -5 near the cluster center. And I'd love to understand what sort of dynamical models for the cluster produce this extreme mass segregation. We think the slope is well determined. It's not it's robust. It should be, despite incompleteness of the faint end, we think these values are going to stand up. To continue on, binaries on the main sequence, we think we see what looks like an apparent binary main sequence up to 0.75 magnitudes, a factor of 2 above the main sequence. We estimate something like 10% of the stars in the core are, 10% of the main sequence stars in the core are in binaries. There could be a much higher fraction of the very lower main sequence stars in binaries. This is really a statement about that same mass range, factor 2, within factor 2 of the turnoff. And the contamination rate, we think, from chance superposition is off the order of 1%. Finally, blue stragglers. They are the faint blue straggler region of the color magnitude diagram is contaminated in sort of normal HST images for a cluster as dense as 47 tuck. But with this high resolution image, we can get a clean picture of the blue stragglers, and the distribution of blue stragglers is skewed relative to the outer samples, skewed towards high luminosity and somewhat bluer colors in the core of 47 tuck. And whether this could be telling us something about the truncation of blue straggler outside the core remains to be seen. Thank you. A question in the back from Stein.
We'll start here.
Okay, sorry.
I have two comments which are in the nature of questions also. One is a matter of technique. Many observers who have been faced with questions of completeness and blending have used artificial stars thrown into the image as a test, and I'm surprised that you didn't mention having done.
We are beginning to do those, Ivan. We haven't analyzed them completely yet. We're beginning to do the artificial star tests, and we intend to use those to quantify exactly the things you're talking about: incompleteness at the faint end, the chance of blending, all of those things, photometric accuracy. Those are not in a mature enough state yet for me to report at them.
The second thing is, the one astronomical result I've been most interested in from these data is how sharp is the turnoff. It will set an upper limit on the metallicity spread that you can have within the cluster. Do you hope that you can get this accurately?
Let me see if I can refer back to a plot for a second. We're not yet doing the best we can. That's very clear. But let me just go to this one right here. So what you're suggesting is the spread over there would set some limits on any age spread or metallicity spread within the cluster. These are relatively rough. This particular CMD is relatively rough cuts in what we accept. There are three cuts in the CMD. We only accept a star if its estimated photometric error is less than some value. The point spread function subtraction was good, if the residuals look smooth, and we could make much more stringent cuts there and get a much tighter color magnitude diagram that way. I have not tried that for this game. I wanted a reasonably high completeness down to the faint end for this particular purposes. But that's clearly a game we should play, and we will.
I hope you'll also plot against position within the chip because of charge transfer efficiency problem.
Thanks. That's a very good suggestion. We will do that.
Your efficiency of blue stragglers, bright blue stragglers outside the core. If the bright blue stragglers are the most massive blue stragglers, then simple mass aggregation from a few core radii into the core would deplete them on a timescale short compared to their lifetime. And that might account for it. It'd be fun to run a model, check it out. But I should probably have talked to you about it and done something about it by now, but now I have.
If you form blue stragglers through collisions, you form them most likely in or near the core, and if you form them as isolated primordial binaries, it will be more likely outside. Right. And I think that also makes them brighter on average, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't explain the difference in colors, would it, in general? No, but I mean, at a given luminosity, there seems to be a difference in color. Yeah, I mean, it's preliminary, but.
It looked like it was very striking. The sequence of stragglers looked like it could be by eye, look more like an extension of the binary name sequence than an extension of the single structure sequence. Is that just my theorist bias?
You'll have to answer that for yourself. I'm not sure.
And have you looked for what? Have you found any eclipsing binaries among the blue stragglers?
There are variable stars known among the blue stragglers. No eclipsing binaries, I believe, among the 47 type blue stragglers. There are these, they're variables, but not eclipsing binaries among not among the 47 type blue stragglers.
So they could be all single.
Yeah, you're saying this appears to be a continuation of the binary main sequence rather than the. Yeah, it's tough to tell.
That
could
be evolution.
Yeah, true.
Did you put more massive models?
No, not yet. We've only just come up with this very clean CMD, but now is the time to start doing things for that.
If you're somewhat older, you might see something that looks like that.
I mean, you can also see that our photometry, the photometry on the giant branch is not very good on the PC chip here compared to the WIFT. And we can make the giant branch at least as tight as this on this just by playing a few games with the photometry. And that, that should tighten up those errors are on the blue stripe.
Just another comment, Raja. I was really excited to see your extreme mass segregation. I'm going to show you this afternoon that we see the same thing in M4. Not as extreme as this, but very similar.
That's great.
Peter? Yeah, this should point out that this is kind of good news. You got from the index of randomized observations
of the 47 tuck, the paper by Allison Seals, that shows that the luminosities are lower. Even further out, so
right.
Several arc minutes out, and they're also redder blue stragglers.
Some of the blue stragglers further out may not necessarily be extremely massive systems, although it's not clear whether or not they should be mass segregated. What I was thinking is that that in open clusters where there are too many binary blue stragglers to be explained by interaction processes, you can relate the evolution of those systems to just ordinary binary evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And one expects the same thing to be happening in globulars.
Right.
Now, of course, it depends on what the masses of the two components are. The one that one of them has presumably gone through an entire evolution, or is,
mm-hmm.
going through its evolution. Now, you can consider the possibility that some of these may just be ordinary binaries.
Right. I mean, and I guess, Francesco has this in M3, you have these sort of two classes of blue stragglers.
It would be interesting to see outside,
I guess the data set Peter Edmonds was referring to is that Ron Gilliland's sort of outer.
Yeah,
right. Well, that's a CTIO image that goes, it's a 0.9 meter image that goes pretty far out, yeah. I think you need this.
I've been working a little bit with Gianpaolo Piotto on his data. We've got a paper about to submit next week, looking at this issue of the primordial blue stragglers, and I'm not going to go into the detail now, it'll go on AstroPitch when we submit it. But the bottom line there is Gianpaolo sees loosely roughly the same number of blue stragglers in all clusters. I mean, there's a spread, but it's not a correlation with mass you'd expect and things. In globular clusters, this is. Okay. Yeah, so you don't find it going as mass, so you don't find it going as a stronger power of mass as you'd expect from collisions.
So these are faint blue, relatively faint blue stragglers.
Yeah, and so it turns out, I'm not going to describe now, I have to wait to see the paper in a couple of weeks, is that by combining the primordial population that gets depleted because of dynamics and exchanges with the collision population, it actually gives you a pretty flat one. And I have to think about it. I have no idea why that would give you your color differences here, but in this cluster, you're probably in a regime certainly where both populations are contributing. And we'll submit the paper soon anyway, so we'll see it then.
Going to make some report in answer to Roseanne's question that, of course, mass segregation of the primordial binaries goes against that. And this is seen here. The primordial binary fraction is lower out there than it is in the core. So if you want to make blue stragglers that have evolved from the primordial binaries, they're going to be in the core because they're massive.
Because they're massive, right.
On the other hand, once they get into the core, rather than being in point, then they get into collision. So
I think the main point
that
there is some differentiation. We
between collisionally formed blue stragglers and the stragglers that should be there because there was something more of an iron in the morsel.
Yeah, I have a question. Just looking at the blue stragglers in the two graphs there, are you sure that the difference is not just a fluke of statistics? I mean, do you normalize for the number, total number of points in each of those classes?
Yes. So I don't know if I have this on this plot here, but I let me see. These are the numbers here. The fraction is roughly 3%. But the error bar is 1% on that. And the other one in the core, it's 7% plus minus 1%. So the difference is sort of significant at the 3 sigma level. I must say, our blue straggler samples are not complete. I'm just showing you two chips out of the four in HST. We have slightly better statistics than that. I think the difference in luminosity between inner and outer blue stragglers is very difficult to make that go away with just statistical fluctuation. Also, we see this in other clusters as well. So,
cross-correlated the position of the red straggles with the millisecond pulsar position?
I have not done that, but I don't know if has anyone done that.
Yeah. Because in that region, we found the optical counterpart to a binary millisecond pulsar 6397.
In that region of the CMD, in that region of the CMD. Yes, yes.
These are variables that.
Possible.